We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. On Perpetual Chess, I have weekly conversations with chess players, personalities, authors, and adult improvers about their lives, their careers, and about chess improvement. Perpetual Chess is brought to you through the generosity of its Patreon and PayPal supporters. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. Hey everyone, welcome back to Perpetual Chess, Chess Books Recaptured. For those new to this format, this is a now monthly bonus podcast where we take a break from interviewing chess luminaries and have a conversation about a famous chess book. So far, I've had guest hosts help me out and discuss the life and games of Mikhail Tal. Sam Copeland and I talked about that a few months back. Reassess Your Chess with Todd Kennedy, and Bobby Fischer Goes to War with Chris Wainscott. All of those are available in the archive for free, as always. And this week, we're going to be discussing another true classic, although perhaps slightly less universally beloved than the other books, as we'll discuss. It is the book Think Like a Grandmaster, 1971, by Grandmaster Alexander Kotov. And here to discuss it with me, we have someone who really, short of getting Alexander Kotov, may he rest in peace himself, there's very few people who I would be more excited to dissect this book with. He's someone who should be familiar to a lot of you. He's been on the show as a guest in October of 2018. He is a cognitive scientist, a USCF master. He is also the co-author of the popular book and psychology study, The Invisible Gorilla. So a bit of an expert on thinking and chess. So who better to bring in at this moment than Christopher Chabri? Welcome back, Chris. How have you been?
I've been great. Thanks for having me do this with you. This is sort of the best podcast I could ever imagine being on.
Wow, that's so nice of you to say, and thank you. I'm really touched that you offered to do this. I know that you're a busy guy, dad, with a lot of professional responsibilities as well. And if our outline and our back and forth from email is any indication, you have not been slacking on the preparation.
No, I probably did too much preparation, but I was, as I guess we'll discuss, I was really excited to be able to read this book carefully and in detail and think about it since I hadn't really thought about it in a long time. So it was a great opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of those books that I feel we've had so many guests recommended on the show. Rafael Letao, GM RB Ramesh, adult improver Stepan Tomic. But it's one of those that I think a lot of people might sort of reflexively recommend because they read it at a formative time and it just grabbed them. And we'll get into that more later. But first, Krista, if you could just give a little more for people who have not heard our other interview yet or aren't so familiar with you about, first of all, your background, but also your background with this book.
Sure. So I learned how to play when I was 5 years old, if we want to go all the way back, which was during the Fischer-Spassky match. My father taught me. And I didn't start playing in tournaments until about 5 years later. But at that point, I eventually made USCF master, and my highest USCF rating was in the 2300s. I got really into organizing in the 1980s and also editing chess magazines, started a short-lived thing called American Chess Journal in the 90s, published a few books myself. Then I never quit chess. I quit playing tournament chess, for about 15 years and then sort of got back into it, a lot more when my son started playing about, 7 years ago or so. And, actually trying now to play more actual tournaments and really improve and hopefully reach a new, high in ability or in rating at least. And kind of as part of that process, I've been going back and reading a lot of books, some that I'd read before, some that I never got around to reading, some new ones. And it's kind of funny, I came across, many people mention this book. Many people mention Kotov and they mention Think Like a Grandmaster. And in particular, they mention, one particular thing from it, which is the first, big concept in the book. And I realized that although I had sort of skimmed the book in the past, I'd never really read it all the way through. And then when you started this podcast, what better excuse to go through it and to reflect on it and think about it than this.
Yeah. So to be clear, when I started the recap podcast, not the the perpetual chess more generally. So yeah, and from my background with the book, it's one of those books that I read as a teenager. And again, I think part of the reason that this book landed with so many top players is published in 1971. So anyone around my age, I just turned 43. There weren't that many great books. If you were reading the bulk of your chess books as a teen, this was one that was definitely going to get recommended. And it's unique. I mean, I think it was especially unique for 1971 when it was published. But even now, I mean, it has a sort of unique approach and for that reason, a special place in history. So which version, I mean, of course, this book has had many editions. I read somewhere that it's one of the most popular, best-selling chess books of all time, although it doesn't, it doesn't pop up on the Amazon list. I think it's not as popular, not as well-selling as it used to be. But Chris, which version of the book did you use for our discussion and for your rereading it?
Well, I have owned this book for decades, but as I said, I never read it cover to cover until, last month in preparing for this. So my copy was a paperback Chess Digest edition from 1971. I guess Chess Digest published the American edition at the same time that Batsford published the UK edition, which was the first English translation. And my copy was in descriptive notation, and I didn't get it in 1971. I probably got it sometime in the 80s. It was, I think at the time it was sort of underground literature, like secret knowledge or something like that. You go to the bookstore and it's all Reinfeld and Horowitz and Chernev, and they obviously wrote a lot of great books, but they were nothing compared to Kotov and Think Like a Grandmaster and so on. So it was, I think, kind of a rarity, even back then, or it was sort of like a status symbol almost, like this is the book that has like the real knowledge in it that you don't need once you've gotten past the popular book. But I didn't like to read descriptive notation now. It's sort of too hard to visualize for me. So I went and got a copy of the Batsford algebraic edition from the 1990s, which they have added a few notes by John Nunn and Graham Burgess, I think. But this was before the days of engine checking, which didn't really start until I think, the 2000s and later.
Okay. Yeah. And similar story, except I did read it as a kid, but I have no idea what happened to my original copy. which is, you know, I've moved a lot since then. It's not super surprising. And a lot of my older books were falling apart by some point. So for the purpose of rereading it, I of course, as I've talked about in prior recaptures, I gravitate towards the digital versions. So I went with the Kindle, which was published in 2012. So it does have, I mean, it doesn't seem based on, I actually don't know the degree to which it's engine checked, but it sounds similar in terms of how they approach it to what you say. I mean, legendary GM John Nunn definitely chimes in with a few comments where something that Kotov suggests is, has proven to be wrong, but it's done with a light hand. I mean, there's not a ton of overriding. So I suspect they mostly just tried to let the book stand in its original form.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that for this kind of book, that makes more sense than, like, let's say, an old opening book or even a book of which is just analyzed games or annotated games where the whole point is the quality of the annotations or something like that. That makes sense. Although I do think, maybe we'll get to this later on, I do think they could improve. There could be some improvements in a modern edition of this book.
Yeah, for sure. There could. Although, again, like, I don't feel like it's selling like hotcakes these days. Although, I mean, I guess if they got someone like John Nunn or someone, you know, another well-respected chess author to sort of interject, like obviously someone like a Jakob Augaard or someone who I'm sure will come up later, to interject with their own reflections based on how modern chess is approached. I think that could do well. But if they just narrow, like mildly touched it up, I'm not sure what it would do. So Chess Zeitgeist, at the time of the original publication, of course, as you mentioned, Chris, this was, I mean, you're yourself basically a chess child of the Fischer-Spassky match. So this came right before it. So I've got a few notes here too, but what would you say about the, what should we know about the chess world in 1971?
Well, of course, Fischer was about to play Spassky and had come back, you know, to play after one of his absences and, you know, managed to get into the inner zonal and crush everyone in the candidates matches and so on. But he hadn't won the world championship yet. So I think this was maybe the point in time when the so-called Soviet school of chess was at its apex. And one of the strong impressions I got from reading Kotov's book is how much it represents Sovietism or the Soviet style or the Soviet approach. And he explicitly sets out to say that that's what he's going to do. And obviously with good reason, Soviet players were, you know, the greatest players in the world for the previous 25 years or so, dominated, you know, all the interzonals, candidates and so on, with a couple of exceptions. So, this was the right time to publish this book, I think, to sort of let people in on the secrets of the Soviet school and how to think like a grandmaster. It probably was a great marketing idea for whoever put it out, at least in English at the time. Maybe it was a bestseller among a certain segment because of that. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard for any younger listeners, hard to overstate sort of the awe that people held for sort of the fabled Soviet chess school, and just everyone wanted to know, like, what is it that they're doing? I mean, my chess coming of age was in the early 90s, and that was still how people thought, despite the rise of Fischer. The top 10 players in 1971, the aforementioned Bobby Fischer, who, as Chris said, was making his way through the candidates, running roughshod through the candidate cycle in preparation for what would eventually be a match with then world champion and world number two, Boris Spassky, number three, Viktor Korchnoi, number four, Bent Larsen, number five, Tigran Petrosian, number six, Lajos Portish, number seven, Mikhail Botvinnik, number eight, Efim Geller, number nine, Lev Pologayevsky, and number 10, Mikhail Tal. So seven out of the 10 players were from the Soviet Union. And if anything, that's probably at the lower end of the spectrum, I would guess, over like the prior decade, if you took the top 10 players of each year. I didn't fact check this, but I'm guessing that was because of Fischer's ascendance, that was slightly lower level dominance than before, but it was still just everyone wondering what's in the water in the Soviet Union, what's their secret. And this was a book that really sort of set forth a way of thinking that was popular or that was commonplace amongst the top players in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, and a lot of the contents is very Soviet-centric, as I noticed when I went through it again. I couldn't help but notice that even though it's already 1971 when the book is published, maybe it was completed a few years earlier, but there's not a single Fisher game in the whole book, I think.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, and which is interesting, and from the point of view of what we know in retrospect, which is that Fisher's approach to chess and his great games and so on are very admired nowadays. And so many players even today will say that you have to study Fisher's games, even though he hasn't really played at all in about 30 years, let alone seriously, which was more like 50 years. But at the time, in this presentation, and maybe there were political reasons for it, I don't know, ideological reasons, he was sort of ignored in this book.
Yeah, it's true. It's a good point. And as you highlighted in the notes, and I also couldn't help but notice, there's so many games from Zurich 1953. So it's not just that he was not using Fisher's games. It just seems generally he was, of course, information was disseminated more slowly back then. But I mean, he was using a lot of games that even then we would consider not of the most recent vintage, but although certainly classic games in many cases.
I'm sure that all the Soviet grandmasters knew Fisher's games pretty well, even if they didn't know them quite as well as Botvinnik's and Smyslov's and so on. It's a striking omission, but maybe of course there could be ideological reasons, but I think also he tries in the book to talk about what players have said about their thought processes during games. And obviously it would be more accessible to him to talk to other Soviet players, think about his own thought processes, and to read what has been written in the Russian language. So that may partially explain, you know, the omission of Fisher as well.
Yeah, that's a good point. And you mentioned ideological reasons. It's a little late for me. Sorry. And that calls to mind, of course, Kotov was known to be a sort of Soviet apparatchik. It's, you know, widely reported that he was at least KGB friendly, if not actual KGB. Jenna Sosenko, a wonderful chess author who's been on Perpetual Chess and written some amazing books himself, and of course came up in the Soviet Union before emigrating to the Netherlands, said in the Rise and Fall of David Bronstein. He said, quote, Alexander Kotov, who wielded considerable weight as administrator in the Soviet chess world and whose ties to the KGB were no secret to anybody, was very conscientious about spreading a rumor about the child's name, which was referring to a rumor that one of Bronstein's children was named after Trotsky, which is neither here or there. But the point is that Kotov was widely rumored to be KGB, so he also may have had sort of... he may not have wanted to give a spotlight to Fisher, in addition to, as you said, having more proximity to the other grandmasters. But aside from being a potential KGB member, what other info should we give for Kotov's bio, Chris?
Well, I can't let the story you said go by without just pointing out that this is the original meaning of the word political correctness. That, you know, if you named your son after Trotsky, you know, that would be politically incorrect, and that could come back to hurt you. And this is where the whole concept of political correctness and political incorrectness came from. And it mattered a lot more, I guess, in that society, in that political system and so on at the time. I think Kotov is, you know, I don't know anything about his KGB ties or non-ties. I'm embarrassed to say that I haven't read Sosenko's books and a lot of those histories of sort of Soviet chess. I haven't really gotten around to getting back to those, so I can't say anything about that. But as a player, I should say Kotov is probably best known now as an author. There's one game of his which is super famous, which I'll mention in a second, but he's really best known as an author, and it's for this book, and then the follow-up book, which was called Play Like a Grandmaster, and the follow-up book to that, which is called Train Like a Grandmaster. They're sort of a trilogy. The latter two were published in 1978 and 1981, and he died in 1981, I think. So those books sort of published in the last decade of his life, I think, have defined his legacy most of all. But he had really good results early on in his career. He finished second in the USSR Championship in 1939, which Botvinnik won. He was the third Soviet grandmaster. I didn't know this, but Soviet Union, I did know, had their own grandmaster title system. And he was the third person to get it after Botvinnik and Levenfish. He won the Moscow championship. He was a Soviet co-champion with Bronstein. He won a tournament ahead of Smyslov in Venice. I wish they had more tournaments in places like Venice. It sounds fun.
Yeah.
I think the thing that I remember Kotov most for, besides those three books, especially Think Like a Grandmaster, are another book, which is called The Soviet School of Chess, and a companion book, which is similar but not the same, called The Soviet Chess School, which I think did a lot also besides this book to popularize the whole concept of the Soviet School of Chess and the sort of mystique that attached to it for a long time. His famous game from Zurich 1953, where he obviously, I guess, had a good time considering that he won one of the most famous games of all time, against Yuri Averbakh, who is presently the oldest living grandmaster at age 98. But in 1953, Kotov famously sacrificed his queen for a pawn to lure Averbakh's king forward into a mating net that only closed many moves later. And I think it was a forced win after he sacrificed the queen, but he said he did it without seeing all the way to the end, just, knowing that or believing that if he got White's king to advance deep into Black's position, he would figure out some way of mating, or presumably at least get a perpetual and probably mate. And it's a really striking combination. Anybody should look up Averbakh Kotov Zurich 1953 if you're not familiar with it.
Yeah, Chris, I'm glad you highlighted that game in your notes, because that sent me down the rabbit hole looking at the game. And of course, I didn't remember it offhand, somewhat ashamedly. But as soon as I saw the position with queen takes h3, I was thinking, oh, this game. And then, of course, I read a little bit about it. I watched one of King's Crusher's videos where he talked a little about it. I pulled up an engine and looked at it. So here's what I gleaned. I mean, first of all, it's the interesting color that you provide that he admitted he didn't see a forced win, because he repeats moves just before the 40th move two times. And then, you know, it's one of these sequences where he can repeat and White has no choice. And then on the 40th move, he captures a pawn instead of repeating a third time. So he basically decided to go for it. He presumably was buying time to make time control. And there was a forced win prior to time control, but he didn't and again this is running the Lee Chess analysis board with a Stockfish 10 engine, not a supercharged engine, but probably good enough for these purposes. There was a forced win prior to the 40th move, but it actually was a draw at one moment, but White went wrong. But it's interesting that you mentioned that he admitted that he didn't see the whole thing, because being the author of Think Like a Grandmaster, and I know, I just had the privilege of interviewing Vishy Anand, and he mentioned in an interview that I came across in prepping for that, the idea that top players used to be able to just sort of, like, if there was some nuance that they weren't missing, they could kind of fake their way through it, because they see more than anyone else anyway. But now that we have computers, they don't necessarily see more than what you can check. So anyway, it's nice that he admits that he didn't see the whole sequence. But I mean, it's a striking sacrifice and definitely a game worth checking out. And of course, we'll link to a few resources in the show notes.
Funny thing, as far as I noticed in the book, he actually shows that position before queen takes h3 check, but doesn't give the rest of the game and Think Like a Grandmaster. So he seems kind of modest about it in his most famous book.
Yeah, that's a good point. Huh. And he was pretty much, he was worse a lot of that game. I mean, he only leveled things and gave himself a fighting chance like a few moves before that sacrifice. So yeah, interesting stuff. And he talks somewhere in the book about being a bit of a late bloomer in chess too. So maybe that sort of framed his desire to write so much about how to approach chess.
He developed a lot in his 20s, and I think in by 1953, I think he was around 40 already playing in the candidates tournament. Of course, that was more normal back then than it is nowadays when you look at who's in the candidates tournament. But I think even for the time, he was maybe a little bit of a late bloomer.
Yeah, I think so. And then there's the question, which I think listeners might have gotten a feel for already, but for what level chess player would you say this is a book that is appropriate in terms of chess improvement, Chris?
Well, I would say 1800 plus, 1900 plus is reasonable, but with a couple of caveats. One, it's not, you know, one of the first 10 or 20 or 30 books I would suggest to anyone on how to improve. So it's more of a little bit of a connoisseur's book. And I think it would be fine for lower rated players as well if they approached it from the point of view that it's an interesting book, and it's part of the history of chess literature and part of the history of chess thought, and a major sort of milestone or maybe turning point in how people think about practical chess and chess improvement and so on. So anybody who sort of approaches it from that point of view and tries to pay attention to how it's written and, you know, think about what he doesn't say as well as what he says, I think anyone who's sort of interested in chess books will get something out of it from that point of view. If you really want to improve from it, though, and work hard, yeah, you should probably be, you know, closer to 2000 maybe to get the most out of it.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, definitely not for the faint of heart. And I echo the sentiment. I mean, I've had, you know, these first few recaptured episodes, I've noticed a lot of people on Twitter and in the Perpetual Chess Facebook group saying, like, you know, this inspired me to either reread the book or go out and buy it, which you guys are welcome to do for this book. But I would just echo what Chris said. It certainly has its place. There's some cool quotes. There's some good historical context. But in terms of like my joy of reading out of the four books I've discussed so far, I would probably put this fourth. My personal opinion.
I think in general, books that are 50 years old or more, you know, they're classics. But there have been so much learned about chess and how to improve at chess and how to study chess and learned about chess itself in the last 50 years that it's generally, you know, not a great idea to base your chess improvement on things written 50 or more years ago. They're very interesting and useful, but that wouldn't be the core of like how you would try to get better.
Yeah, you certainly wouldn't read like a nutrition book from 50 years ago as like the, you know.
or a book on how to play great soccer or anything. Yeah. Like that, because the game has changed.
Yeah, it's a very good point. So we're going to get into the meat of the book, beginning with talking about the structure and reading the first sentence. But first, we're going to take a quick break to hear about our friends at Chessable. So you guys are hearing Christopher Shibri and I talk about Think Like a Grandmaster, a classic book whose place in the chess canon is unquestioned, but which may not be the most practical book for club players looking to improve. For that purpose, might I recommend checking out Chess Strategy for Club Players by I.M. Herman Gruten on Chessable.com. Utilizing Chessable's Move Trainer technology and Chess Strategy for Club Players, you'll learn about pawn structure, piece placement, getting a lead in development, creating and exploiting open files, identifying weaknesses, taking advantage of a space advantage, king safety, and lots more. I.M. Gruten has been on the show. It's an incredible wealth of information, so go to Chessable.com and check it out. Okay, so Chris is going to read the beginning of the book, and Chris, you decided the preface, beginning with the preface, would be more reflective?
Yes, so there's a two-page preface in this book before he gets to the introduction, which is where the real meat of the book starts, but I think the first paragraph of the preface is less weird and kind of maybe explains what's going to happen a little bit better than the first paragraph of the introduction. So he writes in 1971, or whenever he actually finished this manuscript, quote, "An immense number of books have been written on chess. Some chess writers annotate recent games, others compile and bring up to date works on opening variations. But, strange as it may seem, no one has had the idea of describing the methods by which the leading players of our time have reached the peak of their playing strength. Yet a study of these methods would greatly facilitate the process of mastering the intricacies of the game." Unquote. And I think that really is kind of describes what he thought was unique, I suppose, what he thought, and I think is pretty true. It's kind of unique in the chess literature at that point to really talk about the thinking process more than just about positional concepts, tactical ideas, strategy, and so on. He talks more about what should be going on inside your head while you're playing.
Yeah. Yeah, I should have done more digging on like what were the most popular chess books at that point. I mean, certainly there are some classics, you know, My System, Chess Fundamentals, Lasker's Manual of Chess, some of the Richard Reddy books. I mean, there were some classics that I can think of that existed at that point, but I don't know what was like commonly considered a classic at that time. But it certainly, I suspect that this was a pretty big breakthrough in terms of the way that chess thought was dissected. I mean, which of course brings us to the major themes of the book. And of course, this book is most famed for a few themes laid out in the first chapter.
Yeah, you want me to sort of
yeah
with that?
Yeah, if you're up for it.
Yeah, there are five chapters in this book, but really the first one is the only one that anyone remembers, I think, and which is a little bit of a shame because I found there to be some interesting stuff in the rest of the book that I had no idea existed until I went back, to it now. But everybody talks about the first one, the first chapter, so I'll sort of describe that. So it's called Analysis of Variations, and it starts with a section called Do You Know How to Analyze, which, you know, usually I think the rule of thumb is if someone asks a question in a title, the answer is no. So the answer is you don't know how to analyze according to Kotov, but he's going to tell you how in the next subsection of chapter one called the Tree of Analysis. So the Tree of Analysis is one of the two most famous concepts that comes out of this book. And in a way, it's almost trivial to think about nowadays because anybody who knows anything about computer chess knows that computers analyze chess positions by constructing a tree, starting from the position on the board and then, you know, thinking about every possible legal move in that position. And then from each of the positions that results from all of those legal moves, all the possible legal moves from there, and you've got this gigantic tree with millions and millions and hundreds of millions and billions of possible positions. And that's what computers search through as fast as they can. Kotov was actually suggesting that human beings, and in particular grandmasters, structure their thinking process by creating a tree in their minds. And he wasn't just saying the grandmasters do it. He was really prescribing it, advising it as the algorithm that players should follow if they want to play well. And so the Tree of Analysis was the main idea of Chapter 1. And I guess it was kind of revolutionary at the time. The other main idea is candidate moves. And the idea there was that the way to construct the tree of analysis is just to start with the position on the board in front of you. And before you analyze any variations, before you start that mental dialogue of if I go here, he goes there, and then I play bishop takes e3, and then he plays f takes e3, but I don't like that because such and such. Before you start all that process, the calculation process, you should list in your mind or think about all the possible candidate moves that you want to analyze. And then you should, of course, should do that for your opponent. Once you start analyzing the first of your candidate moves, then you should think in the resulting position, what are the moves my opponent might play? So it's a very prescriptive, orderly, systematic algorithm almost for calculating variations that he claims will help you make better decisions at the board, and that's the way grandmasters are thinking. And I guess if I were going to continue to go on about this, I would say he has a few important sub-rules for this. One is it's very important to enumerate the candidate moves first before you start analyzing them. It's very important to evaluate one fully before going to the next one. So if you're thinking, should I play bishop b5 or should I play knight f6, well, first you come to a conclusion about what bishop b5 will lead to before you start analyzing knight f6. And then when you're done with both of them, then you compare and see which one is better. And you don't recheck your analysis. So once you're done analyzing bishop b5, never go back and analyze it anymore. Trust in what you concluded the first time you analyzed it. And that will, of course, fight time pressure, but I think he also thinks it will sort of force you to develop confidence in your and trust in your own calculations as well. And so it's a very... That's his prescription for how to think about what to play. And I guess nobody had really written out systematically how to analyze a position while you're playing a game.
Yeah. And that's, again, as you mentioned, that's what it's most famous for. I mean, people talk about selecting candidate moves all the time. And certainly that is a concept that has stood the test of time. Other aspects of the book, as you alluded to in our notes, Chris, maybe are not quite as universally acknowledged by other grandmasters. And one thing to note is just he's quite strident. I mean, I guess when you write a book, if you're going to lay out a case, I mean, I guess you would know this better than me, Chris, it doesn't do any good to dilly-dally and dither about what your thesis is. But he's really quite dogmatic that this is the way it should be done. And I think that might be part of the reason why some people have pushed back. But particularly, I mean, the idea of candidate moves is quite good. Has stood the test of time. But the idea of never double checking your variations, I think, is a little more controversial. And certainly, I have whether or not you should think that way, It is not something I've managed to do. And I think a lot of people might struggle with it. But what are some of the other reactions that you came across in prepping for this discussion, Chris?
Well, as I said, the one reason why I was interested in this book was I had seen so many reactions to it already. It's been written about a lot. And I'll give a flavor of a couple of them. Mark Dvoretsky, has written several series of books, some in collaboration with Arthur Yusupov. Some of his books contain chapters written by other people. So he's actually said quite a bit about Kotov, and maybe in part because of his Soviet Russian background, he generally adopts a very respectful tone towards Kotov. So, for example, in Dvoretsky's book Attack and Defense, which was the fifth volume of the first series of his books that came out from Batsford in the 1990s and really, sort of brought Mark Dvoretsky to the attention of the rest of the world besides Russia at the time, said Kotov was perhaps the first to highlight this divisive calculation. He recommended that you should immediately identify all the possible candidate moves, not just for your first move, but for subsequent ones, and not just for yourself, but for your opponent. But this principle by no means always works. Nevertheless, it is very good advice for many situations. So Dvoretsky sort of even himself, while saying it was, a groundbreaking work and so on, says, well, it doesn't really work all the time. But he points out, this is one of the interesting things. I think he points out what you noted, Ben, which is that the candidate move idea is much more useful than the tree of analysis idea. And the candidate move idea is the one that has really survived and you find all over the place nowadays, even while people don't talk about the tree of analysis at all. And Dvoretsky gave three reasons why making sure you explicitly think about candidate moves before you start just going into the analysis is useful. He said, first, it helps to survey the variations rationally. So I think by that he means it does provide some structure to your analysis, so you don't just constantly jump back and forth or wonder whether you should be still thinking about the position or whatever. If you think, well, okay, here are three moves I'm going to look at, and you do them one after the other, you have some kind of structure to your thoughts. It helps to avoid spending a lot of time on one variation and then like looking at the clock and saying, oh no, I've got to make a move, and never having even studied anything else, but just in a sense you wasted your time. If you spent a lot of time analyzing one variation, one move, and didn't leave yourself enough time to analyze anything else, you might as well just played that move and saved yourself the time for the future, right? That's
been there, done that.
Yeah. Well, I have that problem myself. I mean, I noticed when reading the book that some of the problems he identified in thinking, Kotov identified, and I think legitimately are problems I have. Like often I will feel like I'll invest a lot of time and I don't know what the right word is, but sort of like emotion in a particular candidate move. And I'll analyze it very concretely and I don't come to a conclusion, but I can't sort of move away from it because it's something I really know about.
Yeah.
So dividing your time between different candidate moves explicitly, I think would help to fight against that. And then Dvoretsky's third point is one that other authors have really dwelled on even more, which is that this idea that you can only look at, one move completely and then switch to another move and then switch to another move stops you from doing what Dvoretsky said was, we sometimes discover resources, the existence of which we never suspected at the outset. So he means that when you're analyzing one move, you might discover an idea in analyzing that move that would also apply to one of the other candidate moves. Or you might discover a new candidate move because you're analyzing one line and you say, oh, if only my pawn were already here, then my opponent wouldn't be able to play this reply. And so then it occurs to you, maybe I should move my pawn there first. And now you're back to the root of the tree, adding a candidate move, which is totally against Kotov's algorithm. So even Dvoretsky, who's respectful and descended, and maybe is sort of like what became the modern avatar of the Soviet school in some ways, even he has to sort of modify Kotov's dicta.
Yeah. And just for any listeners, I think a lot will be, but for any listeners not familiar with Dvoretsky, his books have been recommended almost every week on Perpetual Chess. He's probably the most respected trainer and chess author of all time. And he ascended after Kotov, but I'm sure there was some overlap. So they probably had some personal interactions as well, which may have, as you say, the criticism is gentle, but valid in my mind. Okay. So, and you had a few other reactions from authors that you noticed as well, right, Chris?
Yeah. I mean, I'll just list a few out briefly because it's remarkable to me how many people spent time in their own books just responding to Kotov's book. So, you know, Willie Hendricks has this book with the fantastic title, Move First, Think Later. One of the best chess book titles of all time. He actually responded to one of Kotov's other statements. He just sort of dismisses the tree of analysis out of hand, saying it's impractical. But Kotov has also made the statement in that same book that it's better to have a bad plan than to have no plan at all. And Hendricks, you know, emphasizes that that's not necessarily true, that a bad plan can be worse than no plan. And I don't know if Hendricks points this out, but I think with the rise of players like Magnus Carlsen, who often seem to be playing sort of without the traditional grand plans that you think of from people like Tarash and Capablanca and so on, but just, you know, playing to improve his position. As he once famously said, you know, my goal for this game is just to make 40 good moves. Hendricks, I think, sort of alludes to those weaknesses in some of, you know, Kotov's dicta. In particular, Jonathan Tisdall, who wrote a fantastic book called Improve Your Chess Now, and John Nunn, who's wrote a very underappreciated book called Secrets of Practical Chess, both began with a whole chapter basically responding to Kotov's tree of analysis and pointing out the impracticalities of it, you know, how people maybe really think and how they should think. And Matthew Sadler, in his book Chess for Life, said that once he tried to mold his thinking process according to Kotov's rules, and then he played a tournament right after that, and he said, quote, I didn't play well in that tournament, and truth be told, I didn't enjoy playing one bit either. By structuring my thinking, I turned myself into a machine, and not a very good one at that. So a lot of the modern authorities, you know, now are sort of seriously questioning Kotov's whole concept. None of them really question candidate moves, although often they say, like, you shouldn't enumerate them all at the start. But everybody seems to agree that sort of consciously thinking about candidate moves is a good idea. But other than that, it's not really clear that much survives from the whole tree of analysis, how to calculate variations recommendation of Kotov.
Yeah, and I basically all of those authors and books you mentioned, I would say maybe reading their books should be a higher priority for listeners, unless you're just really into Soviet era chess and really into the history aspect. I think that all of those are better books for chess improvement, in my humble opinion. I lost my train of thought. Do you have anything to add, Chris?
I don't disagree. I love all those books, and they're more recent and up to date. A lot of them even talk about, you know, how to use computers in your play and so on, which is a topic that's totally alien to Kotov, obviously. So I think there are other books that are better for improvement. But if you want to understand the history of sort of how we got to our current beliefs about improvement, and if you want to understand where this candidate move concept came from that everybody talks about nowadays, even, you know, Jakob Ogard talks about it all the time. One of his whole like types of exercises is called finding the candidate moves. And he's written about Kotov in several of his books. If you want to understand where all that came from, it's a really great place to start. And there's a lot of good material for improvement in it. You know, it's just like, don't be gullible and think that because this Soviet grandmaster who found queen takes h3 check says you've got to think this way, that it means that he was thinking that way when he found queen takes h3 check, or that it's really the right way to think.
Yeah. And speaking of the first chapter, you mentioned that you didn't make much of an effort to do the calculation. The way I approached it is, once I started getting into the book and realized, like, oh man, I forgot how labor intensive this book is actually supposed to be in terms of the calculation exercises, I decided I would read the prose first and go back and do some of the calculation later. And yeah, it's really hard. I mean, and I find it in its presentation, I find it harder than a lot of sort of the more tactically oriented how to calculate books that you might come across these days. I mean, there's just thickets and thickets of variations. So obviously that can be a good way to approach chess. Like when I, interviewed Grandmaster Eugene Perelstein, he talked about how had he had taken some lessons from, I believe it was Grandmaster Yusupov, who of course worked with Dvoretsky, wrote books with him extensively. And he talked about the bulldozer method. And then of course, Eugene is a, you know, he emigrated from the former Soviet Union, from the Ukraine to the U.S. In, I believe, his early teens. So he touched that world. And basically what he called the bulldozer method was you just take a position and you calculate everything. You know, you calculate like, you know, six candidate moves, 10 moves deep. You just they basically just drill you. And other than the fact that it wasn't as many candidate moves, I mean, there's a lot of that in the sort of calculation part of this chess book. It's definitely not for the faint of heart. And I find, I don't know. I mean, maybe it would be better for my chess, but I wasn't inspired to dig in that deep.
It's the kind of thing that sounds like it really should be good for your chess, doesn't it? Like this sounds like really like hitting the gym for like 3 hours straight or something. Yeah,
exactly.
You know? But as I think Jan Gustafsson said, you know, where's the data on whether any of this stuff really works? You know,
right, yeah.
If you put data on whether it really works up against sort of Soviet pronouncements, I'll take the data, I guess, and or the absence of the data, I think probably means something. Not to say that calculation exercises aren't good. Everybody seems to agree on that, and there's reason to believe it. But 60 minutes on one position versus, you know, 10 minutes each on six positions, who knows? I mean, I think I said something like this when I was on the regular podcast, that if it's too aversive to actually make yourself do, it's probably not a good study method because it's not going to do anything for you if you don't do it.
Yeah, yeah.
yeah. So I think it feels to me like we're on solid ground in saying that practicing calculating variations in complex positions has got to be a good idea, because so many games are decided by miscalculation. Even if you don't hang a piece or something like that, the miscalculation of something is probably what decides most games.
Yeah. Okay. Well, on that note, I think we can move on to a topic that it will be a little more, praising of this book, the favorite quotes. And there are some gems in here for sure. I pick some long quotes just because they give you, especially because we're not saying you should rush out and buy this book necessarily. I mean, certainly if you have it, dust it off the shelves and take a look. And you know, there's nothing wrong with supporting Batsford Chess, especially because Kindle books are, in particular, are cheap, although we'll get to some formatting issues with it later. But anyway, on to the first quote, which is the idea of Botvinnik or Nydorf, which this is Kotov's words, where he says, "From my earliest top class tournaments, I've examined my colleagues closely and taken an interest in how they behave during a game. Some sit down at the board 5 minutes before play is due to start and get up only when the game is finished or it's time to adjourn it. Others jump up as soon as they've moved and walk around quickly, quite happy to talk to the other players. Botvinnik has always been an example of Olympian restraint and concentration. Only in recent years has he allowed himself a little rest by walking once or twice round the stage during a game. His exact opposite is Nydorf, who cannot sit still. He only walks around the stage when it is not his turn to move, but he also pats his fellow players on the cheek, exchanges a joke with them, and never forgets to ask his favorite question, 'Where do I stand?' I myself was always somewhere in the middle, but a little closer to Nydorf. However, I must confess that I was always a little annoyed with myself for this. What a fidget. Always jumping up can disturb your analysis and tends to make decisions superficial. On the other hand, how can you bring yourself to sit still for 5 hours? What did Botvinnik do to occupy himself when his opponent was thinking?" And that's the end of the quote. So of course, Chris, you can reflect on that quote more generally, but I also would like to know if you're a Botvinnik or a Nydorf.
I don't know what their relative ages were at the time. They were probably pretty close in age, Botvinnik and Nydorf. Maybe Nydorf was younger. Maybe that partly explains it. I think it's changed for me a little bit over time. I used to be bad at sitting still during the game, and I would often get up and walk around and look at other games and so on. Then somehow I got better at it, maybe just because I felt I wasn't playing as well and I had to keep thinking, and I was sort of like, shortchanging the effort that I needed to put in if I didn't, you know, if I got up and walked around. But I have to say, in my last tournament, I found myself often getting up and walking around, and just the walking, I think, probably helped. So I don't know. I guess I'm a little bit of each. I think we probably all contain a little bit of Botvinnik and Nydorf. I'm really glad you picked out this quote because there's several interesting, I think there's several interesting things about this. Do you mind if I start with the one about the where do I stand?
In a minute. Yeah, we'll get to that. But I did just want to mention, of course, you're in the unique circumstance that your son is playing in the tournament. So that's got to make it even harder to just focus on your own game.
That's true. I do get up and look at his game every so often. But I noticed one of my opponents recently was getting up and walking around behind me and looking at the board from behind me. And in fact, maybe standing a little too close sometimes. So I'm trying to be very careful of not disturbing anyone when I do this. But it's more just to sort of pace around and I don't really know why I do it. It just feels like the right thing to do at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. And for the record, I historically definitely have been a Nydorf, much to my detriment. Mike Shahadi, senior master, and Greg and Jen's dad was one of my formative chess teachers. Shout out to Mr. Shahadi. And he always talked about Zitzfleisch, a well-known term in the chess world, basically meaning the ability to just sit on your ass and concentrate. And I had medium to low Zitzfleisch, I would say. Definitely was something I could be better at. But let's get to your quote about where do I stand, Chris, from this quote.
The funny thing is, in my copy of the book, which I don't know why the translation is different between yours and mine, because I think there's one English translation by Cafferty, I think, who translated lots of Russian chess books. In mine, it says, how do I stand? And I interpreted that as meaning he was asking people, what do you think of my position? Am I winning? You know, how am I doing? Which at first I thought was kind of shocking, because nowadays you can't ask other people to opine on your position and evaluate it for it. You can't go ask Stockfish where you stand, you know, or how you stand. So why should you be able to ask a human being? Maybe there's some translation issue and it doesn't imply what I think it implies. But on the other hand, there used to be a much more casual attitude towards talking during games. I would do it myself. I would talk about the game. You would try not to get advice. Like you might talk to someone about your game and say, "Oh, I'm a pawn up. I think I'm better, but I'm not sure whether I can win." And you would not expect them to say, "Well, if you would just, you know, play King H2 and Rook G1, then your king would be safe, and you can then do blah blah blah." It was more sort of like a, I don't know what it was, but it wasn't sort of an advice-seeking function. But the way it's phrased here, it seems like Nydorf is asking people to evaluate his position, which seems awfully strange.
Yeah, I kind of take it that way, whether it's where do I stand or how do I stand. And I have to admit, I have a sort of unique history with this. When I was playing my most chess as a teenager in Philly on the Eastern Seaboard here in the U.S. In the early 90s, there were lots of Russian emigres playing chess, and they would talk during the games all the time. And in fact, when I went to college and I needed to fulfill a language requirement, that was why I decided to study Russian, because I was just like, I want to know what the hell they're saying during my games. You know, I need to know this. And I've talked to other chess players who studied Russian for similar reasons. And, you know, having lived in Russia for a few months, but having studied the culture and stuff, I mean, there's just generally a different set of rules about, you know, propriety, I would say. I mean, I don't want to paint with too broad a brush, but I mean, the stories of Soviet collusion and so on and so forth are well known. And just a general sort of different approach to what is right and what is wrong. So, it's strange that he would be so open about it. But I also, you know, as you say, there used to be a fine line between like overt cheating versus just generally sort of opining on the feel of a position.
I guess another thing is that like games used to be even longer back then, right? Like you would play for 5 hours and then you'd adjourn, and then you'd play for another 5 hours and then maybe adjourn again. So maybe there was just like more time for chit chat. The time control was 40 moves in 2.5 hours. Maybe there's more time to get up and walk around. But he attributes this to Nydorf, who's not a Soviet or Russian player.
That's a good point. So yeah.
maybe there's a little projection going on there or something. I don't know.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, that's a very good point. So do you want to hop in with one of your favorite quotes, Chris?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, one thing that I noticed is he says at one point, In one of the later chapters, I believe, not the first chapter about the analysis of variations, but one of the later chapters, which I guess I should have said are on topics like positional judgment, planning, the end game, and a player's knowledge, which is sort of a hodge, you know, like sort of a potpourri chapter at the end. But in one of those later chapters, he says, quote, "There is one type of move that has always won my admiration and respect. It happens that a position looks quite level and one cannot see any way of gaining an advantage for either side when suddenly there comes a simple, insignificant looking move. In a trice, one's assessment is changed as the opponent's position is now seen to be indefensible." And he calls the unquote, and he calls those moves creeping moves. And in fact, most of the examples he gives are one square moves by the queen, like queen from c6 to b6 or queen from g4 to h4 or something like that. And I just thought like those were, you know, those are moves that nowadays you might attribute to the style of, you know, Karpov or Carlsen, who seem to make a bunch of insignificant moves and then suddenly have a winning position. Of course, not all the time, but that's, I think, a characteristic of their games that is often remarked on. And he, of course, he didn't have them to talk about. He gives an example from a game between Spassky and Korchnoi in the 1968 Candidates final match. And what I thought was ironic about it is, and maybe the reason why Kotov is so impressed with these moves is that it's probably very hard to find them using his algorithm.
Right.
Because the reason he even explains that Spassky played queen from c6 to b6 because on b6, the queen is protected. So some tactical resource that his, that Korchnoi had wouldn't work in the most important line because the queen is guarded on b6, but not on c6. And the way that Spassky probably figured that out was analyzing the line first without putting the queen on b6 first, realizing that it doesn't work, and then saying, oh, if only my queen were on b6. So he generates a new candidate move by analyzing the first candidate move. He generates a new candidate move, which he goes back and puts in his list at the beginning and then analyzes, which is all out of sync with Kotov's formula, but it's exactly what people like Tisdall and Nunn and Dvoretsky and Ogard and so on, you know, say is exactly what should happen. That's the normal thought process, is you have to analyze the position to find all of the good moves.
Yeah, that's a really good insight. And it is a nice, it's a nice position, the Spassky-Korchnoi game. So I'll link to it and people can check it out. But that's a really interesting insight that, yeah, kind of goes against what he advises. So the next quote I will read is having to do with regular listeners might know one of my bugaboos over the board, time trouble. So he is talking about time trouble. It's good to know that even a cognitive scientist deals with time trouble, Chris. So quote number two is, "Time trouble is blunder time. Can you justify these blunders by pointing out how short of time you were? No, you cannot. Nobody will take much notice. No official will change the result in the tournament table. I advise you to develop a sternly critical attitude to time trouble errors. Following the example of Valjekin, who wrote one of his moves in a game against Tyler, Nottingham, 1936, a horrible move. And in my opinion, the fact that White was in time trouble when he made it is no more justification than the claim of a lawbreaker that he was drunk when he committed the crime. The inability of the experienced master to cope with the clock should be considered as faulty as making an oversight in analysis. Remember that."
Obviously, he's completely right. And yeah. And whenever I make a mistake in time pressure and I have to explain it to my coach, I say, "Well, I know this is not an excuse. It's an explanation."
Right. Yeah.
I was exactly in time pressure, and I know that if I had played faster sooner, I might not have made this mistake.
Yeah, and I do feel like later in the book, the candidate move and tree of analysis chapter is very concrete. But in these quotes, as the book goes on, I do feel like you do start to see his personality a little bit more, Kotov's, and that is I think that's one of the better things about the book is in my experience, again, I haven't read a ton of chess books published before 1971, but the ones that I have were not as conversational as he eventually loosens the reins and becomes at this point in the book.
It's so interesting from a psychological point of view that time trouble, even though it's almost as important or maybe more important than a lot of other skills, managing time trouble is more important than a lot of other skills in chess. It seems to me to be very sort of personality related and maybe age related. and so on. It's not the kind of thing where you can just like read a book and learn how to like you can learn how to play the Steinitz variation of the French, maybe from books and from playing games and studying games and so on. What do you study to fix time pressure? It really seems like a personality trait almost, or at least something that's, you know, very deeply behaviorally ingrained. And all of the exhortations from Kotov and everybody else are good. They should be stated. But I wish someone had a really good sort of behavioral training method to really cure people of time pressure. I would pay money for it.
Yeah, it's so hard. This sort of, you know, I tried to trade stocks for a while, and a lot of that is a sort of about trying to reprogram your brain. And this is getting into your territory, Chris, but there was some author I read somewhere who talked about what he called the hot cold empathy gap, where in you read something and you want to implement it, but then you reach a certain situation at the moment where you're trying to implement the behavioral change, and it's just infinitely harder to actually do it at that moment than to sort of academically understand the need to do it.
Exactly. if only it were so simple. I mean, people like Jonathan Rowson, by the way, in his books talk about this, that, you know, you can, you know, some people approach chess ability as though it's a matter of knowledge, but it's actually a matter of skill.
Yeah.
And have a lot of knowledge and not be able to implement it over the board. And that does not mean you're good at chess. It might mean you sort of know a lot of abstract stuff, but if you can't put it together and use it to make good moves, then you're not good at chess.
Yeah. And speaking of resources, a friend of the podcast, I am Kostya Kavutsky, did come out with a YouTube video a few days ago with some tips about managing time trouble. So obviously I had to watch that given my, even though I'm not playing actively at the moment, I intend to at some point, and when I do, I really need to work on time trouble. So I check that out, and I definitely recommend it for anyone who's struggling with time trouble. So I'll link to that as well.
Maybe we should send it to Grishuk before the candidate.
I would love to see Grishuk. I mean, I like a lot of those guys, but Grishuk has a special place in my heart. So yeah, anything we can do to help him, I'm for. So do you want to read another quote, Chris?
Sure. Let's see. I think another one, I alluded to this earlier, where he says a player who wishes to become a grandmaster must be able to analyze accurately, as that is what decides the majority of games. And so I've said it twice, and I think it really is important. It's easy to overlook that even though you didn't hang anything or you didn't fall into checkmate or something like that, it was probably one or more miscalculation errors that led you to miss better moves for yourself or better moves for your opponent. So it's just reinforcing the, you know, for him, the value of what he's trying to teach. One that surprised me more, though, was where he said, quote, "I can think of few cases where the two bishops proved the decisive factor. On the other hand, I can recall quite a lot of cases where two knights showed the greater energy and really trounced the bishops." I don't know. I was just really kind of shocked to read that, because nowadays there's, I think, pretty solid belief based in part on computers, you know, Stockfish or even, you know, AlphaZero and Leela, that two bishops provide a significant advantage more often than not. And, yeah, you know, Larry Kaufman's piece values, you know, give bonuses for two bishops, and so on. And it was struck that Kotov almost seems to have the opposite view.
Yeah. Yeah. That one probably based on, what the heavyweights say these days, doesn't hold up as well. On to my next quote, which again, it's a little more lighthearted than some of the other stuff in the book. He says, "More often than not, one cannot forecast the moves of one's colleagues, even though grandmasters do not all think in the same way. That is why we love chess. We like the game for its boundless possibilities, for its bold flights of fancy, for the wide scope it offers for the seeking and inventive mind. That is why we call chess an art." So I don't have much to add to that. I just liked the quote. And again, you can see his enthusiasm for the game shining through.
I think it's great that you can understand a lot of it, but not all of it. So when you're following a game, if you're a reasonably good player, the pleasure that you have in understanding the position and maybe being able to predict some of the moves is great. It just doesn't seem like a random, you know, montage of things. But on the other hand, you always get surprised. And that's, yeah, I think he captures that pretty well.
Yeah. So any more quotes, Chris?
I'll throw in one more because I think it relates to the sort of the Sovietism of the book a little bit. And so, for example, he says at one point, "A chess player is the commander, and the fate of the whole army depends on his ability, willpower, and diligence. That is why the question of good or bad peace positions always plays a decisive role. I would read that twice if I didn't want to waste time, because it strikes me that the first sentence had nothing to do with the second sentence, even though the second sentence begins, "That is why." And this, it's sort of like Soviet style rhetoric, you know, the such and such plays a decisive role, and the commander, you know, and the fate of the army and so on. It really almost sounds like some of this, you know, some of this book is written in that style. But I have to say, that was really like the low point. So surprisingly, there was very little that was actually like that. So I don't want people to get the wrong impression that the whole thing is like that. And in fact, it's quite delightful to read.
Yeah, it is.
But there is a little bit of that Sovietism sort of, I think, sort of creeps in, you know, here and there. And then that's nice from a historical point of view, just to sort of see, you know, some traces of the culture that these kind of books come from.
Yeah, I mean, it's just such a different world. I mean, it's easy to forget when you're reading a work of fiction and they take you to a world, you're there with it right the whole way, to know that you're in Moscow in 1971. whereas when you're reading a nonfiction academic treatment of chess, it's easy to lose track of just how different things were and how far away he was from most of the people listening to this and ourselves. So Chris and I, by the way, listeners, I mean, you see the length in the podcast to begin with by the time it's out, but we're not even trying to keep this to an hour. We got some more stuff to do. And Chris and I discussed a rationalization before we started, which is we're not giving as full-throated a recommendation for this book, so we should talk about it more just in case you don't read it. So but we're making decent time, Chris. So let's get to our favorite games or game or games, I should say. Which ones struck you? Of course, we already talked about, as you mentioned, Kotov's most famous game wasn't touched upon that heavily. But anyway, which games of yours did you enjoy? I mean, which games did you enjoy from the book?
He doesn't really present a lot of full games at all. It's almost all fragments. In fact, I think there are some that go straight from the beginning to the end, but very, very few compared to the number that are fragments or even just single positions, you know, that he really goes into in depth when he's talking about how to calculate. And one of those early examples in the book is from Nicholas Rosolimo, who the Rosolimo variation is named after. And that's from that 1950 Venice tournament, which I guess Kotov knew the game because he was there enjoying playing in Venice. And I thought that was nice, that was a position I'd never seen before, but really interesting. And I thought it was really one of the better calculation examples that he has, because it's a kind of position where Rosolimo has done something like sacrifice in exchange for a kingside attack or something like that. And it's the kind of position I think that comes up a lot in everybody's play, where you know the king is exposed, and if you don't calculate properly, you might just wind up down the exchange or more without winning the game. So it's a really sort of critical situation. It's Rosolimo versus Nestler in 1950. And by the way, I guess maybe now would be a good time to point out that someone on one of the websites, I think it's chessgames.com, has done the service of compiling all of the PGNs of all the games that are in this book. So you can go and download that. I think maybe you need to be a member of the site, but you can download that PGN file and then have all the games start to finish, at least, or the fragments, at least, in your, in your database.
Yeah, that was really nice that you sent me that. And of course, I've ranted about stealing books before. That would not qualify as stealing books, as long as you're buying the book as well. And it was helpful because this even the Kindle version is a little bit light on the diagrams, which makes the calculation stuff even harder.
I think all he did was compile the games. Like it's not Kotov's analysis,
right,
or anything.
Yeah.
I think it's just the PGNs of the raw games themselves.
Yeah. Sorry. Should have been clear about that, but it's still helpful because you can have that in front of you, one by one while sitting there with the book.
Yeah. All books should come with that. I realize now, like, it's so much easier to have that in your database, you know, without having to go and search out all these games if you want to run through them in PGN. Of course, if you don't have it in Forward Chess or something like that, but you just want to have it available in case you need to.
Yeah. And as for my favorite book, I went with a more, positional quiet win, Plotter, Botvinnik, 1947, Botvinnik, soon to be world champion. And according to Kotov, it's you know, he calls it a relatively equal position after move 20, and Kotov just has control of the d-file, and he has a bishop against a knight, and it's cited as sort of a canonical bishop against a knight endgame, although Bafanik also has a better pawn structure. But just a nice, clean, classic win. I think part of... I gravitate towards the... I mean, of course, I love the fireworks, too, but I find if you're not going to spend hours studying a game, I often can appreciate those games more. Of course, this is one where you could pick apart what he says about it a little bit. I mean, the engines would actually say that from the point that Bafanik, that he highlights, as you mentioned, it's a game fragment starting around move 20. And the engine would already say that... that Bafanik was like, it was like minus 1.4 or something. Black was doing quite well, even in the starting position. But still, it's a pleasure to play through the way that Bafanik sort of just systematically converts his advantage. And yeah, I'll link to that one as well if anyone wants to check it out online.
Nowadays, isn't that often really because, you know, when the engine searches deep enough, it actually sees the positional maneuvers that... you know, that are going to lead to a plus one, you know, a 1.4 advantage later on, even if materials, even now, it, you know, engines are so good that they can, you know, in searching ahead, they sort of see that the positional advantages will eventually, you know, will eventually snowball. So I'm sort of not that surprised that a modern engine can see, you know, an eventual realization of an advantage from a position that sort of superficially looks relatively equal. That's what they're supposed to be doing, I think.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. Any other games, Chris, or should we move on to improvement takeaways?
I don't have any other specific games. I mean, a couple of points to make are there are a lot of games from Zurich 1953. And so if you've studied Zurich 1953 already, you'll see some things you've already seen. But I think that's okay because a lot of those games, I think, are rightly famous. And he doesn't just include the famous ones. I think there's some relatively lesser known ones that he includes. It does seem that Bronstein's book on Zurich 1953 had an influence on Kotov. And there's also some interesting lesser-known examples from older Soviet players like Romanovsky and even Taimanov, who maybe not that old, but there's some really nice examples from some of those players who, you know, not world championship level or whatever. And that's the kind of thing you wouldn't see as much nowadays in a modern book. Most examples in modern books are from very recently.
Yeah, yeah.
In some ways, the older games are a little bit easier to understand, as a lot of people have said, you know, that players, you know... Well, people just weren't as good, you know, 100 years ago at chess as they are now, frankly. So their games are a little bit more instructive in some ways.
Yeah, and especially if you get a decent sized gap between the players, I mean, you can really have some classically instructive games. Excuse me. Okay. Improvement takeaways. I mean, there's no shortage of improvement takeaways, despite our mild critiques of the book. Number one, this one is sort of a cliche, but I would just say no pain, no gain. I mean, especially when it comes to the calculation portion of the book. I mean, it's really just what you put into it is what you will get out of it. And even if you don't choose this as your calculation book of choice, I mean, there's just no substitute for grunt work.
Yeah, I agree. He does give about 20 or 25 exercises sprinkled throughout the book, which is kind of the way older books were. Modern books, especially, let's say, Jakob Ogard books, or many books have, you know, hundreds of exercises in them, all engine checked and everything like that. So this is not the book to use if you want sort of calculation homework to work on. But Kotov certainly makes the same point that Ogard and other, you know, many trainers make nowadays, that the work practicing calculation will pay off.
Okay. And my number two improvement takeaway was he has a really nice chapter on endgames at the end, which I believe is where the Bafanik, aforementioned Bafanik game came from. But he talks about the importance of thinking in schemes. And he says, he mentions points specific to the end game phase. Number one, think in terms of schemes. Number two, do not be in a hurry. Number three, bring the king as quickly as possible to the center of the board. So, and he mentioned a few players that he noticed were adept at these things in particular. Belenevitz, Flor, and Smyslov thought in schemes in endgames. And that's, you know, for higher level players, that's probably fairly obvious observation. But I think for a lot of club level players, it's so easy to get sort of bogged down in just, I go here, they go there, I go here, they go there. But when you watch stronger players talk about endgames in particular, they have a really impressive ability to just say, like, you know, first you want to lock this pawn structure, then you want to bring your king over here, then you want to do this. And he has a couple good examples of that. But just the general advice of approaching endgames that way in terms of like a multi-step plan.
Can I break the format and read a quote from that chapter?
Yeah, if you're ready.
I happen to have the book open in front of me. And that chapter, by the way, is only 9 pages long. It's the shortest chapter in this 170-page book, but it's really good. I agree with you. Like, he makes like really important points. I love when people write short chapters about the endgame, because you get to find like the 3 or 4 things that they think are most important. And it's surprising that not everybody says the same things. So not everybody says do not hurry. Not everyone talks about schemes. And he gives a great example of what he means by thinking about schemes. Also contains some of that old Soviet culture. So here's the quote. He says, once in a lobby of the Hall of Columns of the Trade Union Center in Moscow, there's old Soviet for you.
Yeah, so yeah, that's evocative. That one sounds like a novel.
I think they played world championship matches there or something like that. I always hear the Hall of Columns, you know, and so on. Anyhow, once in the Hall of Columns in Moscow, a group of masters were analyzing an ending. They could not find the right way to go about things, and there was a lot of arguing about it. Suddenly, Capablanca came into the room. He was always fond of walking about when it was his opponent's turn to move. He was a Neidorf.
Yeah, another callback. Yeah, go
on. Learning the reason for the dispute, the Cuban bent down to look at the position, said, "See, see," and suddenly redistributed the pieces all over the board to show what the correct formation was for the side that was trying to win. I haven't exaggerated at all. Don Jose literally pushed the pieces around the board without making moves. He just put them in fresh positions where he thought they were needed. Suddenly, everything became clear to us. The correct scheme of things had been set up, and now the win was not difficult. We were delighted by Capablanca's mastery and soon had further evidence of the need to think schematically about the ending. So it's kind of an interesting exercise, just like imagine you could put the pieces anywhere.
Yeah.
Would you put them? Like, I shouldn't say never, but, you know, I feel like I've sometimes thought about that in positions like block positions or extremely strategic positions like opposite colored bishops endings where you can sort of maneuver at will, you know, and so on. But that's a great little anecdote that really illustrates the point.
Yeah, thank you for hopping in with that. Yeah, and it underscores the don't be in a hurry point. I mean, they kind of go together.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're gonna be thinking in schemes, then you need not to hurry. So
yeah.
okay, and one more from me, improvement takeaway, and then we'll get to Chris's. He talks about the importance of correct piece positioning. He says, so in conclusion, I should like to emphasize the importance of correct piece positioning. Remember that in seeking the solution of concrete tasks by analyzing variations, you should never allow yourself to be carried away and lose sight of the need for a harmonious link between all your pieces. Take it as a rule once or twice to look at the position from a different point of view during the game. Ask yourself, are my pieces all cooperating or is there some disharmony in their ranks? A quick check like this can be of great help. And this is something someone like Jonathan Rosen talking about, talk to your pieces. Like, this has been talked about a lot more in modern literature, but at the time, I don't think it was as common, and it's just good advice.
Yeah, I think people talked about harmony, you know, before Kotov. Like, I feel like that's even something Capablanca might have written about or something, but he definitely points it out. And I think nowadays the term that a lot of people use is coordination. You know, they'll literally say something like, you know, black is worse because he has bad coordination or something. Yeah. Like that. I think that's like the shorthand you see in, like, you know, when Geary annotates a game in New In Chess or something like that, you know, he'll write something like that, or Spidler will say it in his videos. And it's a little bit of an opaque concept, but I think if you sort of see enough examples, you can start to see what it means. But developing a feel for it, that's maybe a little bit harder, but obviously important.
Okay, Chris, do you want to share a few of your improvement takeaways from this book?
Yes, I think there are many. And the first one I would highlight is to think consciously about candidate moves, even if you can't follow Kotov's algorithm. And in fact, you shouldn't follow his algorithm. But the one thing you should take from it, if nothing else, is think about a few ideas before starting to analyze the first one. Of course, don't be afraid to add more later when you discover other things. But I think I'm pretty bad at this. I myself often don't think about all the possible moves. I just start analyzing the first one that comes to mind or the one that I was thinking about before, before my opponent moved or something. And that's a bad habit. Candidate moves, can't say enough about reminding people of the importance of that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you're only going to take one thing from this book, that should be that.
Yeah. And then the ones that were more surprising to me and that I really had never thought about, the main one was here's a quote. He says, "If I analyze variations only when my clock is going and think of the general considerations while my opponent's clock is ticking away, this would be a great saving in time." This is what he sort of concludes after that whole Botvinnik or Neidorf discussion. He says, "What was Botvinnik doing during all that time he was just sitting?"
Yeah, right.
What was he doing, if it wasn't his move? And Kotov comes up with the idea that you should use some of that time to ask more general questions about the position, like, what is my opponent's plan? What should my plan be? Nowadays, Jakob Ogard and people like Eric Kislik also have sort of suggested questions for what you should think about, like, who benefits if we trade queens? What's my worst place piece and how could I improve it? Sort of more general conceptual thinking that doesn't involve calculation of variations. And that's a great idea because it's hard to know when it's your move. Like, you feel like you're wasting time if you're not calculating, but it's a great behavioral cue if you can implement it to say, well, once it's my opponent's move, let me spend a little bit of time on those other things. And those things also might be easier to think about when you're not standing at the board either. So maybe you could combine walking around with, thinking about some of those other things that don't require perfect visualization of the board.
Yeah. Okay. I have nothing to add on to the next one, Chris.
he emphasizes that plans can be like very small ideas, which I think is important because there's sort of a misconception about planning sometimes that planning is sort of like this grand scheme that operates for the entire game, like a minority attack in the Queen's Gambit exchange variation or something like that. It's sort of like the plan, starts on move 9 and doesn't end until move 70 when you win the rook end game or something. He says a plan is, quote, just a definite strategic idea, a short plan to achieve a concrete objective. And you can have a long series of those. And he quotes Bronstein from Zurich 1953. He says, "There's one feature of modern chess which the reader will notice again and again in the games of this tournament, the readiness of the players to react quickly to a change of plan by the opponent by changing their own plan." End of Bronstein quote. And I think that's something really strong players are good at, and not getting stuck in sort of one kind of thinking or one plan or one idea, and very, very flexible about that. So I think that's a good point.
Yeah, and modern players better than ever at that.
Yeah, and I think that's one reason why Zurich 1953 is sort of regarded as such an important book, is because I think it was the first book that really highlighted, how chess thinking was changing at the time, maybe not accurately all the time, but certainly drew attention to that. And then I want to give one non-takeaway, if I could.
Sure.
Because Kotov says,
oh yeah,
as other people say, he says, he calls it Blumenfeld's rule because a Russian writer named Blumenfeld had, I guess, suggested it. Or that's where Kotov came across it. But he says, you should write down your move before you make it on the board during a tournament game so as to cue yourself to do a blunder check. Writing down the move is your cue to now, like, just make sure you're not blundering and then actually play the move on the board. But alas, that is illegal nowadays. So I think it's a bad habit for anyone to get into because you're just going to have to change it later on. I know some kids are taught to do that and some people think it's not a big deal, but I'm a little bit of a stickler about the idea that you shouldn't be assisting yourself with anything besides your own brain during the game. So writing down your next move on a score sheet is a memory aid and it's, and so on. So I'm kind of in favor of not getting in bad habits.
Huh? Yeah, I guess that makes sense. I mean, I always wrote down my moves before I move, so I've got the opposite bias, but I mean, I don't think I can't defend it objectively, but I mean, it's just another thing that makes chess harder if you're not allowed to write down your move before you make it.
Well, all these rules are kind of arbitrary, right? So some of them have a more principled basis than others, like not asking other people what moves you should make during the game is surely a more important rule than writing down your own move before you make it. But there is, there is some logic to it. It is against FIDE rules, so might as well, not get started on it.
Yeah, we definitely, there needs to be consensus about these things. If it's a rule, it's a rule. How useful for chess improvement? We've touched on this a fair amount. So again, it somewhat depends on your level. I would say the lower your level, the less useful it is. Over 1900, 2000, I would give it like an 8 or something. But below that, it descends pretty rapidly because there's some cool little nuggets like the ones we've just shared. But you'll be doing a lot of reading in between those nuggets if you're like a 1400 trying to study this book. What do you think, Chris?
I would say when it came out, I would give it a 10.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point.
Nowadays, I would give it a 5.
Yeah, exactly.
But if you're like a skeptical reader and, you want to think about the advice and like compare it to other books and so on, I think you will get quite a bit out of it. I found a bunch of ideas I never thought of. I actually thought I'm going to, in my next tournament, I'm going to try to do that thing where when it's my opponent's move and it looks like he's thinking for a little bit, I'm going to try to think about these general considerations more, because I always have trouble like weaving those things into my thought process. So there was like, even if I only got that out of it, it's worth it.
Yeah. And again, on Kindle, it's not expensive. So certainly you can get your bang for your buck with this book, although it's more a question of opportunity cost since chess study time can feel so precious. Quibbles with the book. For me, I mentioned I had the Kindle version. I wish there were more diagrams. Sometimes when these things get quote unquote translated to Kindle for some reason, and like when there's a move like Queen H5 check, it will say KH5 check. Generally with a little thought, you can figure out what they mean, but it's just kind of a weird quirk that you come across. What about you, Chris? What would you change about this book if you could?
I agree. More diagrams. Like I just randomly opened a quality chess book, right now. And, one 2-page spread has 7 diagrams and the next 2-page spread has 4 diagrams. But if you look at this book, each 2-page spread maybe has 1 diagram or maybe 2.
Yeah.
Back in the day, they just didn't put in as many diagrams. And of course that sort of forces you to calculate in your head more, which I guess is part of the point, but it's just a much better reading experience with more diagrams.
Yeah, agreed.
I guess I would say also, I feel like this is, this is such a classic of chess literature. Like, how useful is it for chess improvement? I don't know, maybe a 5. How useful is it for a chess book collection? A 10. So it's the kind of book where I really think there should be a modern edition. Like someone should go and engine check it. Someone should put in footnotes. Some modern trainer should write, an appreciative foreword and maybe analyze, what are the important concepts to retain and not kind of like you said earlier on. But someone really ought to do that. And maybe they could combine it with those other two books of his with similar titles and make sort of like one big, Kotov Bible, 21st century edition or something. Put it on Forward Chess and whatever. That would be cool.
Yeah, that would be cool. I would buy that for sure. So I think we've hit all the major topics on the outline. What would you say? Do you have anything to say in closing, Chris?
In closing, I think it's weird because as we talked before, we're not all saying how great this book is and everyone has to go read it like some of the other books you've talked about. But I think it's a really important book. And it's really important for anyone who likes to collect chess books or likes to understand about chess literature and even understand about sort of how we got to where we are now and our understanding of chess and the Soviet school of chess and so on. It really was one of the first ones to be just about the process of thinking as opposed to being about the truth of chess itself. Very few books before that had mentioned this concept or they were just superficial. And, although Kotov was not realistic, he was definitely not superficial. I think really a lot of the value of this book is that it took a very strong position and made claims that other authors could then react to. And that kind of dialogue between authors is part of what advances knowledge. Capablanca said, you should start by studying the endgame. I'm not sure many people believe that nowadays, but it certainly is a position that other people were able to think about and respond to. And that kind of contribution, you know, can't be underestimated. So I think the book has tremendous value, you know, in history and in the development of chess understanding and chess thinking.
Yeah, well said. I agree. Before we let you go, Chris, I also just want to read a quote. Aforementioned friend of the podcast, Kostya Kavutsky. I really like his YouTube videos. He's doing a good job, and I definitely recommend people check out his catalog. And he also did a video called The Top 4 Most Overrated Chess Books. And one of those books was Think Like a Grandmaster. So when we decided to talk about this book, I felt like I should reach out to Kostya and see if he wanted to give a quote about why he thinks it's overrated. And it echoes some of what we've said, but I'll read Kostya's quote, and you can also check out his video when you get a chance. Kostya says, "In my opinion, Think Like a GM is worth reading overall. It has a lot of instructive examples discussing important aspects of both strategic and tactical play. It's a Soviet chess school classic that would likely be useful for the average club player. I included the book as a dishonorable mention in my video because of the controversial tree of analysis method that Think Like a Grandmaster is best known for. This is described in the first part of the book and comes with some strict recommendations for how one should calculate. Although I believe many players would benefit from structuring their calculation process in a bit more systematic way, I think Kotov takes it too far in terms of rigidity and doesn't capture the reality of what it's like for a strong player to capture several variations at a time. I would refer listeners to John Nunn's Secrets of Practical Chess, where he thoroughly explains the defects of Kotov's method with some real-life examples of the importance of staying flexible during your thinking. So while I definitely feel the book is worth reading to expand one's understanding of chess, I would caution readers against trying to imitate the tree of analysis method for their calculation." End of quote. Yeah.
Well, I think that's all right. I would read Tisdall's book also, Improve Your Chess Now, and maybe Pump Up Your Rating by Axel Smith or other, you know, really good commentaries on calculation. And of course, Jakob Ogard's books as well. And Dvoretsky's, those are all great. If you're the kind of reader who tends to sort of believe whatever the author tells you as the truth, then maybe this book is not for you, and maybe no book from the Soviet Union is for you.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And I think Kostya hit the nail on the head. So last thing, Chris, before we let you drop off, before I get to the blindfold chess problems. So I'm once again failing at my attempt to pay people to do this. We may need to revisit this policy, but in the meantime, I'm happy to donate to a chess good cause on your behalf. So Chris, where should I direct this modest donation?
I think charity of your choice is a great way to pay people for doing this joyful activity with you. And I'm a big fan of Michael Regan's tournaments with the Maryland Chess Association. And I understand he raises money for the Washington International, which they have every summer and which I hope to play in someday. So I suggest you donate whatever you were going to pay me to that tournament instead.
Yeah, I will gladly do so. And if anyone heard my interview with Michael Regan, I mean, people like that are the often unsung heroes of the chess world. I mean, just donating so much time just so that people can have a pleasant playing experience. And Michael in particular is making the experience especially pleasant. So we'll happily support that cause.
Yeah, he's not the only one doing great stuff, but I just happen to know he's got a nice donation button there and that, you know, it's a great event. So
yeah, I mean, it's always hard to choose. There's so many worthy causes in the world and in the chess world. So, but yeah, definitely a good choice, and I'm glad to support it. So, Chris, thank you so much. I mean, thanks for putting all this work in and sharing so much insight. And I know that you had mentioned before that you'd be willing to do more than one book. So 90 minutes and 1 month later, can I still hold you to that at some point?
Sure, but give me like a refractory period to recover from this one.
Of course, yeah.
Start on the next one.
Oh yeah, I have plenty of volunteers, and I'm eager. I haven't figured out where I'll go next yet, but yeah, I mean, you're such a font of information about chess and about thinking. So hard not to take advantage once you've recuperated.
Okay, great. Looking forward to it.
All right, Chris, thanks a lot. And we will get you back on the regular pod at some point too, because I know you've got some more stories to tell.
Sure, it would be great.
All right, guys, it's Just Ben now back for the Blindfold Puzzles of the Month. For those who have not listened before, we try to leave you after each chess book recaptured with a blindfold puzzle that you can either take or leave, attempt to solve it. If you are going to attempt to solve it, please be safe. If you're driving, be careful or pull over. If you're on a treadmill, maybe slow it down. We don't want anyone to crash while they're exercising their brain. So puzzle number one, I'm guessing, is about 1400 level. It's an endgame puzzle. It is white's move. It's going to be white to move and win. Here's the piece placement. White has pawns on c5, d5, and f4. And white's king is on b2. Black has pawns on d7, e7, and h7. And black's king is on b5. So to repeat, white has pawns on c5, d5, and f4, and white's king is on b2. Black has pawns on d7, e7, and h7, and black's king is on b5. And as usual, if you look in the show description, I'll have two links. The first one will have just the position without the answer, and the second link will say solution, and there you can go if you're stumped. On to puzzle number two, which I think is a little bit harder. It's another one of these mate and two puzzles where white has a bunch of pieces and black doesn't have any other than the king, and the king's in the middle of the board. So not the most practical chess puzzle in real life, but I think it can be a good visualization exercise. And this is taken from the Step series, as was the one I used in the Life in Games with Mikhail Tal recap puzzle. So white to move and mate and two, guessing 1900s to 2000 level. Here's the pieces. White has pawns on f2 and g4. White has a bishop on f5. White's queen is on h8. And white has a king on d8. Black's king is on g5. That's it for black. So once again, black king on g5. And then white has pawns on f2 and g4. A white bishop on f5. A white queen on h8. And the white king is on d8. And it is white to move and checkmate in two. So that's it for this month's edition of Perpetual Chess Chess Books Recaptured. Thanks for listening, everyone, and I will catch you guys soon. Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible. That includes my producer, Matthew Passy, for his timely and capable editing, chessable.com for their generous support of the show. But I also want to thank everyone who helps spread the word about Perpetual Chess, whether it be by telling a friend, writing a positive review on Spotify or YouTube, or we could use some new reviews on Apple Podcasts. If you're enjoying the show, please write a quick review. It helps spread the word about Perpetual Chess. But most of all, I want to thank the people who support the show financially. People who donate via PayPal or Patreon really help me continue to sustain and grow Perpetual Chess. And those who donate more than $5 a month get their name or entity's name read on the outro. That's about to happen right now. So I would like to give special thanks to the following people and entities for their generous support of Perpetual Chess. They are Chessable.com, Quality Chess Books, the Capital City Chess Club, the Apprend Chess Twitch Channel, Andrew Bach, Austin Clough, Benjamin Porteau, Kathy Carr, Chad Oliver, Dan O'Hanlon, Danny Davidson, David Schreiber, I am Dimitri Schneider, Faraz Sawaf, Gary Foreman, Greg Natel, Greg Shahadi, Guven Manet, Jens Green, John Jernigan, John Rockefeller, John Cromarty, John MacArthur, Kelly Palmer, Kevin O'Callaghan, Lone Pine Chess, Lorraine DeRay, Lucio Casada Silva, the Law Offices of Stuart Katz, Michael Kahn, FM Michael Oblin, Mike Zelazny, Moonmaster 9000, Moonmaster, we need a question from you. Is everything okay? We need you to send in a listener question. Peter Soddy, Reuven Fisher, Seattle Chess Club, Thomas Donix, Thomas Tachenko, Todd Bryant of Strong Chess, and Todd Kennedy. I would also like to thank the following Rook level supporters. They include Aaron Wafflar, Ace Vallega, Adam Ralph of ChessEngland.com, Adrian Gutierrez, Alex Pejas, FM Andre Terikov, Andrew Perry, Aniti Deer, Better Chess Training, Bill Juniper, Bill Moran, Brad and Andy Rosen, Brett Howard Lynn, Brian Mullis, Chad Hilton, Dr. Charles Snodgrass, Chris Flanagan, Chris Wayne Scott, Christopher Baumgartner, Christopher Shabri, Chris Lott, Christopher Wood, I am Christoph Zalecki, aka Chess Explain, Coach J's Chess Academy, Courtney Fry, David Bleskachek, Daniel Gell, Daniel Ginsburg, Daniel Lucas of the U.S. Chess Federation, Daniel Naylor, Dave Saylor, David Cramley of Chessable.com, Dwayne Edmonds, Ethan Smith, I Am Elect, or possibly not I Am Elect. I don't know if Three Norms makes him an I Am Elect. Donnie Ario, Fox Valley Chess Club, Francis Letarte Lavoie, Frank Tortorice MD, Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Geert Vandervelt, Gerard Barta, Giovanni Russo, Hans Schutt, Harish Srinivasan, Jacques Perry, James Aspinwall, James Bonastia, James Murr, Jason Anfang, Jason Woolham, Jaydeep Chakrabarty, Jeff Anderson, Jeffrey Martello, Jerry Wells, JJ Strnad, Dr. John Fallon, John Fernandez, John Fontaine, John Hartman, John Jeffrey, John McMurtry, Jordan Goodwin, Jose Rodriguez, Justin Gardner, WGM Jen Shahadi, Joel Rocky, John Thompson, GM Josh Friedel, I Am Kare Christensen, WGM Katarina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, I Am Kostya Kovutsky, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Larry Reiforth, Laura Belyavsky, Martin Knudsen, Matthew Passy, Matthew Tedesco of SeattleChessMeetup.org, Mechanics Institute Chess Club of San Francisco, Michael Alerd, Miguel Arispide, Mike Clem, Mr. Mike Shahadi, Nate Salon, Neil Bruce, Olaf Mueller-Michaels, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Passy Passam, and Paul Bain, Paul Clarkson, Paul Sweeney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Randy Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Richard Hallenbeck, Roy Yearwood, Ryan Berg, the Say Chess YouTube channel, Scott Doherty, Scott McKinnon, Sebastian Finsterwater, Stefan Roller, WGM Tatya Vabrahamian, Tim Brennan of TacticsTime.com, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, Tom Edsel, Tomas Komanich, Tony Rotella, Tyron Price, Wayne Beam, William Brock, William Juniper, William Hogarth, William Peterson, FM Zhao Jiang of Chess1000.com, and Zhivko Stoyanov. Thanks, as always, for listening and interacting with the Perpetual Chess community, and I will catch you guys next week.
Podcast Network.
Lucky Land Casino asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.